in Canadian open flat agricultural space. In the sequence The Far Field, 1964, for instance, but in less subtle ways as well. His voice has a naive sincerity in it, a quiet, even tone, and his vision is of a vast nature. Flat ground is as important to Retke's psyche, and therefore to his poetry, as the steep terrain of the English Lake District famously was to William Wordsworth. As readers, we need to consider Retke's Midwesternness as a major element in the making and shaping of his poems. Seamus Heaney, who in Bogland, 1969, actually offers a rejoinder to Retke, in which he acknowledges that Northern Ireland has to get by without prairies. Probably couldn't be a poet at all without a landscape filled with bogs and turf. His imagination runs through history, digging its way down into the past to unlock clues to political and historical difficulties in much the same way the turf cutters carve their way downward through progressively older layers of peat, where they sometimes come upon messages from the past, skeletons of the extinct giant Irish elk, rounds of cheese or butter, Neolithic quernstones, 2,000-year-old bodies. He makes use of these finds, of course, but he also finds his own truths by digging through the past. If we read Heaney's poetry without understanding the geography of his imagination, we risk misunderstanding what he's all about. For the last couple of centuries, since Wordsworth and the Romantic poets, the sublime landscape, the dramatic and breathtaking vista, has been idealized, sometimes to the point of cliché. Needless to say, vast and sudden mountains, the geographic features we find most spectacular and dramatic, figure prominently in such views. When in the middle of the 20th century, W. H. Auden writes, In Praise of Limestone, 1951, he is directly attacking poetic assumptions of the sublime. But he's also writing about places we can call home, the flat or gently rolling ground of limestone country, with its fertile fields and abundant groundwater, with its occasional subterranean caves, and most important, with its non-sublime but also non-threatening vistas. We can live there, he says. The Matterhorn and Mont Blanc, those emblems of the romantic sublime, may not be for human habitation, but limestone country is. In this case, geography becomes not only a way by which the poet expresses his psyche, but also a conveyor of theme. Auden argues for a humanity-friendly poetry, challenging certain inhuman ideas that have dominated poetic thinking for a goodly period before he came along. It doesn't matter which prairie, which bog, which mountain range, which chalk down or limestone field we envision. The poets are being fairly generic in these instances. Hills and valleys have a logic of their own. Why did Jack and Jill go up the hill? Sure, a pail of water, probably orders from a parent. But wasn't the real reason so Jack could break his crown and Jill come tumbling after? That's what it usually is in literature. Who's up and who's down? Just what do up and down mean? First, think about what there is down low or up high. Low, swamps, crowds, fog, darkness, fields, heat, unpleasantness, people, life, death. High, snow, ice, purity, thin air, clear views, isolation, life, death. Some of these you will notice appear on both lists, and you can make either environment work for you if you're a real writer, like Hemingway. In The Snows of Kilimanjaro, 1936, he contrasts the leopard, dead and preserved in the snow on the peak, with the rider dying of gangrene down on the plain. The leopard's death is clean, cold, pure, while the rider's death is ugly, unpleasant, horrible. The final result may be the same, but one is so much less wholesome than the other. D.H. Lawrence offers the contrasting view in Women in Love. The four main characters, tired of the muck and confusion of life in near-sea-level England, opt for a holiday in the Tyrol. At first, the alpine environment seems clean and uncluttered, but as time goes on, they, and we, begin to realize that it's also inhuman. The two with the most humanity, Birkin and Ursula, decide to head back downhill to more hospitable climes, while Gerald and Gudrun stay. Their mutual hostility grows to the point where Gerald attempts to murder Gudrun and, deciding the act isn't worth the effort, skis off higher and higher until only yards from the very top of the mountains, he collapses and dies of, for want of a better term, a broken soul. So, high or low, near or far, north or south, east or west, the places of poems and fiction really matter. It isn't just setting, that hoary old English class topic. It's place and space and shape that brings us to ideas and psychology and history and dynamism. It's enough to make you read a map. Chapter 20. So Does Season. Here's my favorite snippet of poetry. That time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few do hang, upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs, where late the sweet bird sang. As you know, that's Shakespeare's Sonnet 73, your constant bedside reading. I like it for a lot of reasons. First, it just sounds wonderful. Say it out loud a couple of times and you'll start to hear how the words play off each other. Then there's the rhythm. I often recite it in class when I'm explaining meter and scansion, how the stressed and unstressed syllables function in lines of poetry. But the thing that really works here, and in the next 10 lines, is the meaning. The speaker is seriously feeling his age here and making us feel it too, with those boughs shaking in the cold winds, those last faded leaves still hanging, if barely, in the canopy, those empty limbs that formerly were so full of life and song. His leaves, his hair, have mostly departed, we can surmise, and his appendages are less resolute than formerly. And of course, he's entered a quieter period than his youth had been. November in the bones. It makes my joints ache just to think about it. Now to the nuts and bolts. Shakespeare didn't invent this metaphor. This fall middle age cliché was pretty creaky in the knees long before he got hold of it. What he does brilliantly is to invest it with a specificity and a continuity that force us to really see not only the thing he describes, the end of autumn and the coming of winter, but the thing he's really talking about, namely the speakers standing on the edge of old age. And of course he, being himself, pulls this off time and again in his poems and plays. "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?" he asks. "Thou art more lovely and more temperate." What beloved could turn her back on that one? When King Lear is raging in his old man's madness, he's doing it in a winter storm. When the young lovers escape to the enchanted woods to sort out their romantic difficulties, and thereby take their proper places in the adult world, it is a midsummer night. Nor is the issue always age. Happiness and dissatisfaction have their seasons. A thoroughly unpleasant king, Richard III, rails against his situation by saying, his voice dripping with sarcasm, "Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York." Even if we don't know what he means by that, we know from his tone what he feels, and we're pretty sure it doesn't say anything good about this son, with its play on son, of York's future. Elsewhere he speaks of seasons as having each their appropriate emotions, as in the song from Cymbeline, with its "fear no more the heat of the sun, nor the furious winter's rages." Summer is passion and love, winter, anger and hatred. The book of Ecclesiastes tells us that to everything there is a season. Henry VI, Part 2, gives us the Shakespearean formula for the same thing, although a bit more mixed. "Sometimes hath the brightest day a cloud, and after summer evermore succeeds, barren winter, with his wrathful nipping cold. So cares and joys abound as seasons fleet." Even his titles tell us seasons matter with him. A Winter's Tale, Twelfth Night, that is, the last of the 12 days of Christmas, A Midsummer Night's Dream. Of course, seasons aren't the private playground of our greatest writer. We sometimes treat old Will as if he's the beginning, middle, and end of literature, but he's not. He began some things, continued others, and ended a few, but that's not the same at all. A few other writers have also had something to say about the seasons in connection with the human experience. Take Henry James, for instance. He wants to write a story in which the youth, enthusiasm, and lack of decorum that mark the still comparatively new American Republic come into contact with the stuffy and emotionless and rule-bound world that is Europe. He must overcome an initial problem. Nobody wants to read about geopolitical entities in conflict. So he needs people, and he comes up with a pair of real beauties. One is a girl, American, young, fresh, direct, open, naive, flirtatious, maybe a little too much of each. The other is a man, also American, but long resident in Europe, slightly older, jaded, worldly, emotionally closed, indirect, even surreptitious, totally dependent on the good opinion of others. She's all spring and sunshine, he's all frosty stiffness. Names, you ask? Daisy Miller and Frederick Winterbourne. Really, it's just too perfect. And obvious. You wonder why we don't feel our intelligence has been insulted. Well, for one thing, he sort of slips the names in. And then the emphasis is really on her surname, which is beyond ordinary. And her hometown, which is Schenectady, for crying out loud. We get so involved with those aspects that the first name seems to us merely a quaint holdover from the old days, which weren't old to James. In any case, once you pay attention to the name game, you pretty much know things will end badly since daisies can't flourish in winter, and things do. On one level, everything we need to know is there in those two names, and the rest of the novella pretty much acts as a gloss on these two telling names. Nor are the seasons the exclusive property of high culture. The mamas and the papas, expressing dissatisfaction with winter, gray skies, and brown leaves, do some California dreamin' as they wish their way back to the land of perpetual summer. Simon and Garfunkel cover much the same unhappy ground in A Hazy Shade of Winter. The Beach Boys made a very lucrative career out of happy summerland with all those surfing and cruising songs. Head for the beach with your surfboard and your Chevy convertible in a Michigan January and see what that gets you. Bob Seger, who is from Michigan, goes nostalgic for that first summer of freedom and sexual initiation in Night Moves. All the great poets know how to use the seasons. For about as long as anyone's been writing anything, the seasons have stood for the same set of meanings. Maybe it's hardwired into us that spring has to do with childhood and youth. Summer with adulthood and romance and fulfillment and passion. Autumn with decline and middle age and tiredness, but also harvest. Winter with old age and resentment and death. This pattern is so deeply ingrained in our cultural experience that we don't even have to stop and think about it. Think about it we should, though, since once we know the pattern is in play, we can start looking at variation and nuance. W. H. Auden, in his great elegy, In Memory of W. B. Yeats, 1940, emphasizes the coldness of the day Yeats died. Auden had the great good fortune that it happened to be true. Yeats died on January 31, 1939. In the poem, rivers are frozen, snow falls, the mercury settles to the bottom of thermometers and won't budge. Everything unpleasant winter has to offer, Auden finds it for his poem. Now, the traditional elegy, the pastoral elegy, has historically been written for a young man, a friend of the poet, often a poet himself, who died much too young. Typically, the elegy turns him into a shepherd taken from his pasture, hence the pastoral part, at the height of spring or summer, and all nature, which should be rejoicing in its fullness, instead is sent into mourning for this beloved youth. Auden, an accomplished ironist and realist, turns this pattern around in memorializing not a youngster, but a man, born at the end of the American Civil War and dead on the eve of World War II, whose life and career were very long, who had made it to his own winter, and who died in the heart of meteorological winter. That mood in the poem is made colder and more desolate by Yeats's death, but also by our expectations of what we might call the season of the elegy. Such a tactic requires a very great, very skilled poet. Fortunately, Auden was one. Sometimes the season isn't mentioned specifically or immediately, and this can make the matter a bit trickier. Robert Frost doesn't come right out and say in After Apple Picking that it's now October 29th or November umpteenth, but the fact that he's finished his apple picking informs us we're in autumn. After all, wine saps and pippins don't ripen in March. Our first response may not be, "Oh, here's another poem about fall," although, in fact, this may be the most autumnal poem in the world. Frost expands on the seasonal implications with time of day, late evening, mood, very tired, tone, almost elegiac, and point of view, backward-looking. He speaks of the overwhelming sense of both tiredness and completion, of bringing in a huge harvest that surpassed even his hopes, of being on a ladder so long that the sense of its swaying will stay with him even after he falls into bed, the way a fishing bobber watched all day will imprint itself on the visual sense of eyes closed for sleep. So harvest, and not only of apples, is one element of autumn. When our writers speak of harvests, we know it can refer not only to agricultural but also to personal harvests, the results of our endeavors, whether over the course of a growing season or a life. St. Paul tells us that we will reap whatever it is that we sow. The notion is so logical and has been with us so long that it has become a largely unstated assumption. We reap the rewards and punishments of our conduct. Frost's crop is abundant, suggesting he has done something right, but the effort has worn him out. This, too, is part of autumn. As we gather in our harvest, we find we have used up a certain measure of our energies, that in truth, we're not as young as we used to be. Not only has something come before, in other words, but something else is coming. Frost speaks in the poem not only of the coming night and his well-earned sleep, but of the longer night, that is winter, and the longer sleep of the woodchuck. Now this reference to hibernation certainly fits with the seasonal nature of the discussion, but that longer sleep also suggests a longer sleep, the big sleep, as Raymond Chandler called it. The ancient Romans named the first month of our calendar after Janus, the god of two faces, the month of January looking back into the year gone by and forward into the one to come. For Frost, though, such a dual gaze applies equally well to the autumn and the harvest season. Every writer can make these modifications in his or her use of the seasons, and the variation produced keeps seasonal symbolism fresh and interesting. Will she play it straight or use spring ironically? Will summer be warm and rich and liberating, or hot and dusty and stifling? Will autumn find us toting up our accomplishments or winding down, arriving at wisdom and peace, or being shaken by those November winds? The seasons are always the same in literature and yet always different. What we learn finally as readers is that we don't look for a shorthand in seasonal use. Summer means X, winter Y minus X, but a set of patterns that can be employed in a host of ways, some of them straightforward, others ironic or subversive. We know those patterns because they have been with us for so long. How long? Very long. I mentioned before that Shakespeare didn't invent this fall/middle age connection. It predates him by a bit, say, a few thousand years. Nearly every early mythology, at least those originating in temperate zones where seasons change, had a story to explain that seasonal change. My guess is that the first thing they had to account for was the fact that when the sun disappeared over the hill or into the sea at night, the disappearance was only temporary. Apollo would drive his sun chariot across the sky again the next morning. About the time the community had a handle on this cosmic mystery, though, the next item on the agenda, or next but one, was probably the matter of spring following winter, the days growing shorter but then growing longer again. This, too, required explanation, and pretty soon the story had priests to carry it on. If they were Greek, they would come up with something like this. Once upon, etc. There's a beautiful young girl, so stunningly attractive that her beauty is a byword not only on Earth but in the land of the dead, where the ruler, Hades, learns of her. And Hades decides he has to have this young beauty, whose name is Persephone, so he comes up to Earth just long enough to kidnap her and spirit her away to the underworld, which, confusingly enough, is also called Hades. Ordinarily, the theft of even a beautiful young girl by a god would go unchecked. But this particular girl is the daughter of Demeter, the goddess of agriculture and fertility, a happy combination, who goes instantly and permanently into mourning, leaving the earth in perpetual winter. Hades doesn't care, because like most gods, he's very selfish and he has what he wants. And Demeter doesn't care, because in her selfishness, she can't see beyond her own grief. Fortunately, the other gods do notice that animals and people are dying for lack of food, so they ask Demeter for help. She travels down to Hades, the place, and deals with Hades, the god, and there's a mysterious transaction involving a pomegranate and 12 seeds, of which only 6 get eaten, in most versions by Persephone, although sometimes by Hades, who then discovers he's been tricked. Those 6 uneaten seeds mean she gets to return to Earth for 6 months of every year, during which time her mother, Demeter, is so happy that she lets the world grow and be fertile, only plunging it back into winter when her daughter has to return to the underworld. Hades, of course, spends 6 months of every 12 sulking, but he realizes that even a god can't beat pomegranate seeds, so he goes along with a plan. Thus, spring always follows winter, and we humans aren't buried in perpetual winter. No, not even in Duluth. And the olives ripen every year. Now, if the tellers of the tale were Celts, or Picts, or Mongols, or Cheyenne, they'd be telling a different version of this tale. But the basic impulse, we need a story to explain this phenomenon to ourselves, would remain constant. Death and rebirth. Growth and harvest and death, year after year. The Greeks held their dramatic festivals, which featured almost entirely tragedy, at the beginning of spring. The idea was to purge all the built-up bad feeling of winter from the populace and to instruct them in right conduct toward the gods, so that no negativity would attach to the growing season and thereby endanger the harvest. Comedy was the genre of fall, once the harvest was in and celebrations and laughter were appropriate. Something of the same phenomenon shows itself in more modern religious practice. Part of the immense satisfaction of the Christian story is that the two great celebrations, Christmas and Easter, coincide with dates of great seasonal anxiety. The story of the birth of Jesus and of hope is placed almost on the shortest, and therefore most dismal, pre-electric, day of the year. All Saturnalia celebrate the same thing. Well, at least this is as far as the sun will run away from us, and now the days will start getting longer and eventually warmer. The crucifixion and resurrection come very near the spring equinox, the death of winter and beginning of renewed life. There is evidence in the Bible that the crucifixion did in fact take place at that point in the calendar, although not that the birth took place anywhere near December 25th. But that may be beside the point, because from an emotional standpoint, and quite apart from the religious significance of the events for Christians, both holidays derive much of their power from their proximity in the calendar year to moments on which we humans place great emphasis. So it is with books and poems. We read the seasons in them almost without being conscious of the many associations we bring to that reading. When Shakespeare compares his beloved to a summer's day, we know instinctively, even before he catalogues her advantages, that this is way more flattering than being compared to, say, January 11th. When Dylan Thomas recalls his enchanted childhood summers in Fern Hill, 1946, we know something more is afoot than simply school being out. In fact, our responses are so deeply ingrained that seasonal associations are among the easiest for the writer to upend and use ironically. T.S. Eliot knows what we generally think of spring, so when he makes April the cruelest month and says we were happier buried under winter snows than we are having the earth warm up and start nature's and our juices flowing again, he knows that line of thought will bring us up short, and he's right. Seasons can work magic on us, and writers can work magic with seasons. When Rod Stewart wants to say in Maggie May that he's hanging around too long and wasting his youth on this older woman, he makes it late September. When Anita Bruckner, in her finest novel, Hotel du Lac, 1984, sends her heroine off to a resort to recover from a romantic indiscretion and to meditate on the way youth and life have passed her by, what point in the calendar does she choose? Late September? Excellent. So, Shakespeare and Ecclesiastes and Rod Stewart and Anita Bruckner. You know, I think we might be onto something here. Interlude. One story. We've spent quite a while thinking about specific tasks involved in the activity of reading, such as considering how this means X, that signifies Y, and so on. Now, of course I believe this and that and X and Y matter, and on some level, so do you, else we would not be at this point in our discussion. But there's a greater truth, at least as I see it, behind all these specific interpretive activities, a truth that informs and drives the creation of novels and plays and stories and poems and essays and memoirs, even when, as is usually the case, writers aren't aware of it. I've mentioned it before and have employed it throughout, so it's no very great secret. Moreover, it's not my personal invention or discovery, so I'm not looking for credit here, but it needs saying again. So here it is. There's only one story. One story. Everywhere. Always. Wherever anyone puts pen to paper, or hands to keyboard, or fingers to lute string, or quill to papyrus, they all take from and in return give to the same story, ever since Snorg got back to the cave and told Ankh about the mastodon that got away. Norse sagas, Samoan creation stories, Gravity's Rainbow, the tale of Genji, Hamlet, last year's graduation speech, last week's Dave Barry column, On the Road and Road to Rio and The Road Not Taken, one story. What's it about? That's probably the best question you'll ever ask, and I apologize for responding with a really lame answer. I don't know. It's not about anything. It's about everything. It's not about something, the way an elegy is about the death of a young friend, for instance, or the way the Maltese Falcon is about solving the mystery of the fat man and the black bird. It's about everything that anyone wants to write about. I suppose what the one story, the story, is about is ourselves, about what it means to be human. I mean, what else is there? When Stephen Hawking writes A Brief History of Time, what is he doing except telling us what home is like, describing the place where we live? You see, being human takes in just about everything. Since we want to know about space and time and this world and the next, questions I'm pretty sure none of my English setters have ever really pondered. Mostly, though, we're interested in ourselves in space or time, in the world. So what our poets and storytellers do for us, drag a rock up to the fire, have a seat, listen to this one, is explain us and the world, or us in the world. Do writers know this? Do they think about it? A. Good heavens, no. B. Absolutely, yes. C. Let me try again. On one level, everyone who writes anything knows that pure originality is impossible. Everywhere you look, the ground is already camped on. So you sigh and pitch your tent where you can, knowing someone else has been there before. Think of it this way. Can you use a word no one else has ever used? Only if you're Shakespeare or Joyce and coin words, but even they mostly use the same ones as the rest of us. Can you put together a combination of words that is absolutely unique? Maybe occasionally, but you can't be sure. So too with stories. John Barth discusses an Egyptian papyrus complaining that all the stories have been told and that therefore nothing remains for the contemporary writer but to retell them. That papyrus, describing the postmodern condition, is 4,500 years old. This is not a terrible thing, though. Writers notice all the time that their characters resemble somebody. Persephone, Pip, Long John Silver, La Belle Dame Sans Merci, and they go with it. What happens if the writer is good is usually not that the work seems derivative or trivial, but just the opposite. The work actually acquires depth and resonance from the echoes and chimes it sets up with prior texts, weight from the accumulated use of certain basic patterns and tendencies. Moreover, works are actually more comforting because we recognize elements in them from our prior reading. I suspect that a wholly original work, one that owed nothing to previous writing, would so lack familiarity as to be quite unnerving to readers. So that's one answer. But here's another. Writers also have to practice a kind of amnesia when they sit down, or, like Thomas Wolfe, who was very tall and wrote on top of the refrigerator, really, stand up to write. The downside of the weight of millennia of accumulated practice of any activity is that it's very heavy. I once psyched out a teammate in an over-30 men's basketball league quite by accident. We were practicing free throws before a game when something occurred to me, and like an idiot, I couldn't keep it to myself. "Lee, have you ever considered," I asked, "how many things can go wrong when you shoot a free throw?" He literally stopped in mid-shot to offer his view. "Damn you," he said. "Now I won't make one all night." He was right. Had I known I could have that kind of effect, I'd have warmed up with the other team. Now consider Lee's problem if he had to consider not merely all the biomechanics of shooting a basketball, but the whole history of free throw shooting. You know, not too much like Lenny Wilkins, a bit of Dave Bing, some of Rick Barry, before he switched to the two-handed underhand shot, plenty of Larry Bird, but don't plagiarize him outright, none at all of Wilt Chamberlain. What are the chances any of us would ever make a free throw? And basketball only dates back about one century. Now, consider trying to write a lyric poem with everyone from Sappho to Tennyson to Frost to Plath to Verlaine to Li Po looking over your shoulder. That's a lot of hot breath on the back of your neck. So, amnesia. When the writer gets to work, she has to shut out the voices and write what she writes, say what she has to say. What the unremembering trick does is clear out this history from the front of her mind so her own poem can come in. While she may never, or very rarely, think at all about these matters consciously, she's been reading poetry since she was 6, when Aunt Tilly gave her Robert Louis Stevenson's A Child's Garden of Verses, burns through a couple of volumes of poetry a week, has read most of Wallace Stevens 6 or 7 times. In other words, the history of poetry never leaves her. It's always present, a gigantic subconscious database of poetry, and fiction, since she's read that too. You know by now, I like to keep things fairly simple. I'm no fan of the latest French theory or of jargon of any stripe, but sometimes we really can't do without it. What I'm talking about here involves a couple of concepts we need to consider. The first, as I mentioned a few chapters back, is intertextuality. This highly ungainly word, denoting a most useful notion, comes to us from the great Russian formalist critic Mikhail Bakhtin, who limits it pretty much to fiction. But I think I'll follow the example of T.S. Eliot, who, being a poet, saw that it operates throughout the realms of literature. The basic premise of intertextuality is really pretty simple. Everything's connected. In other words, anything you write is connected to other written things. Sometimes writers are more upfront about it than others, openly showing, as John Fowles does in The French Lieutenant's Woman, that he's drawing on the tradition of the Victorian novel, and on the works of Thomas Hardy and Henry James in particular. At one point, Fowles writes an especially Jamesian sentence, full of embedded clauses, false starts, delayed effects, until, having thoroughly and delightfully aped the master, he declares, "But I must not ape the master." We get the joke, and the punchline makes the parody better than if he'd pretended he was up to nothing very special, since it says with a wink that we're in on the whole thing, that we knew all along. Other writers pretend their work is completely their own, untutored, immediate, unaffected. Mark Twain claimed never to have read a book, yet his personal library ran to something over 3,000 volumes. You can't write A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, 1889, without being familiar with Arthurian romances. Jack Kerouac presents himself as a free spirit performing automatic writing, but there's a lot of evidence that this Ivy Leaguer, Columbia, did a lot of revising and polishing and reading of quest tales before his manuscript of On the Road, 1957, got typed on one long roll of paper. In each case, their work interacts with other works, and those works with others. The result is a sort of worldwide web of writing. Your novel may contain echoes or refutations of novels or poems you've never read. Think of intertextuality in terms of movie westerns. You're writing your first western. Good for you. What's it about? A big showdown? High Noon. A gunslinger who retires? Shane. A lonely outpost during an uprising? Fort Apache. She wore a yellow ribbon. The woods are full of them. Cattle drive? Red River. Does it involve, by any chance, a stagecoach? No, wait, I wasn't thinking about any of them. Doesn't matter. Your movie will. Here's the thing. You can't avoid them, since even avoidance is a form of interaction. It's simply impossible to write or direct in a vacuum. The movies you have seen were created by men and women who had seen others, and so on, until every movie connects with every other movie ever made. If you've seen Indiana Jones being dragged behind a truck by his whip, then you've been touched by The Cisco Kid, 1931, even though there's a strong chance you've never seen The Cisco Kid itself. Every Western has a little bit of other Westerns in it, whether it knows it or not. Let's take the most basic element, the hero. Will your hero talk a lot or not? If not, then he's in the tradition of Gary Cooper and John Wayne, and later, Clint Eastwood. If he does speak, just talks his fool head right off, then he's like James Garner and those revisionist films of the 60s and 70s. Or maybe you have two, one talker and one silent type. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, 1969. Your guy is going to have a certain amount of dialogue, and whatever type you decide on, audiences are going to hear echoes of some prior film, whether you think those echoes are there or not. And that, dear friends, is intertextuality. The second concept for our consideration is archetype. The late great Canadian critic Northrop Frye took the notion of archetypes from C.G. Jung's psychoanalytical writings and showed that whatever Jung can tell us about our heads, he can tell us a great deal more about our books. Archetype is a $5 word for pattern, or for the mythic original on which a pattern is based. It's like this. Somewhere back in myth, something, a story component, let's call it, comes into being. It works so well, for one reason or another, that it catches on, hangs around, and keeps popping up in subsequent stories. That component could be anything. A quest, a form of sacrifice, flight, a plunge into water. Whatever resonates and catches our imaginations, setting off vibrations deep in our collective consciousness, calling to us, alarming us, inspiring us to dream or nightmare, making us want to hear it again. And again, and again, and again. You'd think that these components, these archetypes, would wear out with use the way cliché wears out. But they actually work the other way. They take on power with repetition, finding strength in numbers. Here is the aha factor again. When we hear or see or read one of these instances of archetype, we feel a little frisson of recognition and utter a little satisfied aha, and we get that chance with fair frequency, because writers keep employing them. Don't bother looking for the originals, though. You can't find the archetype, just as you can't find the pure myths. What we have, even in our earliest recorded literature, are variants, embellishments, versions, what Frye called displacement of the myth. We can never get all the way to the level of pure myth, even when a work like The Lord of the Rings or The Odyssey or The Old Man and the Sea feels mythic, since even those works are displacements of myth. Perhaps it's impossible. Perhaps there never has been a single definite version of the myth. Fry thought the archetypes came from the Bible, or so he said at times, but such a notion won't account for the myths and archetypes that lie behind and inform the works of Homer, say, or those of any storyteller or poet who lacked access to the Judeo-Christian tradition. So let's say that somewhere back there in the mists of time when storytelling was completely oral, or pictorial if you count the cave walls, a body of myth began establishing itself. The unanswerable question, it seems to me, is whether there was ever freestanding myth informing our stories, or whether the mythic level grows out of the stories that we tell to explain ourselves and our world. In other words, was there some original master story for any particular myth from which all subsequent stories, pallid imitations, are displacements? Or does the myth take shape by slow accretion as variant story versions are told and retold over time? I incline toward the latter, but I don't know. In fact, I doubt anyone can know. I also doubt whether it matters. What does matter is that there is this mythic level, the level on which archetype operates, and from which we borrow the figure of, for instance, the dying and reviving man, or God, or the young boy who must undertake a long journey. Those stories, myth, archetype, religious narrative, the great body of literature, are always with us, always in us. We can draw upon them, tap into them, add to them whenever we want. One of our great storytellers, country singer Willie Nelson, was sitting around one day just noodling on the guitar, improvising melodies he'd never written down, never heard in quite those forms. His companion, a non-musician whose name I forget, asked him how he could come up with all those tunes. "They're all around us," old Willie said. "You just reach up and pick them out of the air." Stories are like that too. That one story that has been going on forever is all around us. We, as readers or writers, tellers or listeners, understand each other. We share knowledge of the structures of our myths. We comprehend the logic of symbols, largely because we have access to the same swirl of story. We have only to reach out into the air and pluck a piece of it. Chapter 21. Marked for Greatness. Quasimodo is a hunchback. So is Richard III, Shakespeare's, not history's. Mary Shelley's better-known creation, not Victor Frankenstein, but his monster, is a man of parts. Oedipus has damaged feet, and Grendel, well, he is another monster. All characters who are as famous for their shape as for their behavior. Their shapes tell us something, and probably very different somethings, about them or other people in the story. First, the obvious but nonetheless necessary observation. In real life, when people have any physical mark or imperfection, it means nothing thematically, metaphorically, or spiritually. Well, a scar on your cheek might tell us something if you got it as a member of a dueling fraternity at Heidelberg, and certain self-inflicted marks, Grateful Dead tattoos, for instance, might say something about your musical tastes. But by and large, a short leg is just a short leg, and scoliosis is just scoliosis. But put that scoliosis on Richard III and voila, you have something else entirely. Richard, as morally and spiritually twisted as his back, is one of the most completely repugnant figures in all of literature. And while it might strike us as cruel and unjust to equate physical deformity with character or moral deformity, it seemed not only acceptable to the Elizabethans, but almost inevitable. Shakespeare is very much a product of his time in suggesting that one's proximity to or distance from God is manifested in external signs. The Puritans, only a few years after him, saw failure in business, ruined crops, bankruptcy, financial mismanagement, even disease in one's herd, as clear evidence of God's displeasure, and therefore of moral shortcomings. Evidently, the story of Job didn't play in Plymouth. Right. The Elizabethans and Jacobeans weren't politically correct. So now what, you ask? Meaning, what about 4 centuries later? Things have changed pretty dramatically in terms of equating scars or deformities with moral shortcomings or divine displeasure, but in literature, we continue to understand physical imperfection in symbolic terms. It has to do with being different, really. Sameness doesn't present us with metaphorical possibilities, whereas difference, from the average, the typical, the expected, is always rich with possibility. Vladimir Propp, in his landmark study of folktales back in the 1920s, Morphology of the Folktale, separates the story of the folk quester into 30 or so separate steps. One of the initial steps is that the hero is marked in some way. He may be scarred or lamed or wounded or painted or born with a short leg, but he bears some mark that sets him apart. The tales Propp looks at go back hundreds of years and have scores of variants, and while they happen to be Slavic in origin, structurally, they resemble the Germanic, Celtic, French, and Italian folk tales better known in the West. Many of those tales continue to inform our understanding of how stories are told. You doubt? How many stories do you know in which the hero is different from everyone else in some way, and how many times is that difference physically visible? Why does Harry Potter have a scar? Where is it? How did he get it? And what does it resemble? Consider the ways Toni Morrison marks her characters. One quester, our old friend Milkman Dead from Song of Solomon, bears an initial marking, one leg being shorter than the other. He spends much of his youth adopting ways of walking that will hide his deficiency as he perceives it. Later, he will be scarred twice, once on his cheek by a beer bottle in a fight in Shalimar, Virginia, and once on his hands when his former pal Guitar tries to garrote him and Milkman gets his hands up just in time. In Beloved, Sethi has been whipped so severely in her past that she wears elaborate scars resembling a tree on her back. Her mother-in-law and mentor, Baby Suggs, has a bad hip, and Beloved herself is perfect except for three scratches on her forehead. On the other hand, Beloved is something else again, not merely human. These character markings stand as indicators of the damage life inflicts. In the case of Sethi and Beloved, that life involves slavery, so the violence that marks them is of a very specific sort. But even the others bear signs illustrating the way life marks all who pass through it. Beyond that, though, is another element. Character differentiation. At the end of Sophocles' Oedipus Rex, the king blinds himself, which is very definitely a kind of marking of atonement, guilt, and contrition, and one that he will wear throughout the subsequent play, Oedipus at Colonus. But he was marked much, much earlier. In fact, being good Greeks, we knew this before we arrived at the theater, just from the meaning of the name, Oedipus, wounded foot. If we were headed to the theater to watch a play called Wounded Foot the King, which is what that title means, we'd already know something was up. The oddity of the name, the way it calls attention to a physical problem, suggests that this aspect of his identity will come into play. Indeed, Oedipus's feet are damaged from the thong that was put through his Achilles tendons when, as an infant, he was sent away to die in the wilderness. His parents, fearing the terrible prophecy that he would kill his father and marry his mother, have him taken out to the country to be killed. Knowing how hard it will be for their servant to be the agent of death, they intend for the infant to be left on a mountain where he will perish of exposure. Just to be safe, they cause his feet to be lashed together so he doesn't get up and crawl away. Later, his feet will become a piece of evidence proving that he is, in fact, the doomed infant. You might think that his mother, Jocasta, would be well advised either A, never to remarry, or B, to avoid marrying anyone with damaged ankles, but she chooses option C instead, thereby providing us with a plot. Quite lucky for Sophocles, if catastrophic for poor Oedipus. His scars speak of his personal history, which of course is hidden from him until it is revealed during the course of the play. Moreover, they address the personality of his parents, especially Jocasta, who tried to elude the curse, and of Oedipus himself, who seems never to have inquired as to how he came to have these scars. This lack of inquisitiveness is diagnostic, since the basis of his downfall is his inability to know himself. Something more modern? Sure. Ernest Hemingway. The Sun Also Rises. Modern enough? The novel, which deals with a generation that was damaged in so many ways by World War I, is an ironic reworking of the wasteland motif. Like T.S. Eliot's poetic masterpiece, The Wasteland, it presents a society that has been rendered barren, spiritually, morally, intellectually, and sexually, by the war. Such a treatment is not at all surprising, given the death and destruction of millions of young, virile males. Traditionally, the wasteland myth concerns the struggle, the quest to restore fertility. This quest is undertaken by or on behalf of the Fisher King, a character who exhibits physical damage in many versions. That's the original. Hemingway's Fisher King? Jake Barnes, newspaper correspondent and wounded war veteran. How do we know he's the Fisher King? He goes fishing. Actually, his fishing trip is quite extensive and, in its own way, restorative. It is also highly symbolic. And what, you ask, is the wound that makes him right for the role? This is tricky, since Jake, who narrates, never says. There's only one thing, though, that can make a grown man, looking at himself in the mirror, weep. In real life, Hemingway's own wound was in the upper thigh. In the novel, he moved it just north. Poor Jake. All the sexual desire and none of the ability to act upon it. So what's going on here? Character differentiation, certainly. The missing member sets Jake apart from everyone else in the novel, or any other novel I know of for that matter. It also sets up parallels to the operative wasteland myth. Perhaps a touch of Isis and Osiris thrown in. Osiris was torn apart, and the goddess Isis succeeded in reassembling him except for the part that makes Jake Barnes resemble him. The Osiris myth is an Egyptian fertility myth. Priestesses of Isis took human lovers as symbolical stand-ins for the damaged Osiris, not unlike the way Lady Brett Ashley in the novel takes other lovers because she and Jake cannot consummate their passion. But chiefly the injury is symbolic of the destruction of possibilities, spiritual as well as procreative, accomplished by the war. When millions of young men die in war, they take with them not merely reproductive possibilities, but also tremendous intellectual, creative, and artistic resources. The war was, in short, the death of culture, or at least of a very great chunk of it. Moreover, those who survived, like Hemingway and his characters, were badly damaged from the experience. The Great War generation probably suffered greater psychic damage and spiritual displacement than any other in history. Hemingway captures that damage three times over. Once in the Nick Adams stories culminating in Big Two-Hearted River, 1925, where Nick goes off alone to Michigan's then remote Upper Peninsula on a fishing trip to repair his broken psyche after the horrors of his war experience, a second in Jake Barnes's war wound and the fractured festivities in Pamplona, and a third in Lieutenant Frederick Henry's separate peace, broken by his lover's death in childbirth in A Farewell to Arms. All three cover the same ground of mental damage, spiritual despair, the death of hope. Jake's wounding, then, is personal, historical, cultural, mythic. That's a lot of impact for one little piece of shrapnel. In his Alexandria Quartet, Lawrence Durrell introduces numerous characters with disabilities and deformities of various sorts. Two with eye patches, although one is faking it, and one with a glass eye, one with a hair lip, one who contracts smallpox and is badly scarred, one whose hand, impaled by an accidental spear gun shot, must be amputated to save her life, one who is deaf, and several with limbs missing. On one level, being Durrell characters, they are simply versions of the exotic. Yet collectively, they come to represent something else. Everyone, Durrell seems to be saying, is damaged in some way or other, and no matter how careful or fortunate we might seem to be, we don't get through life without being marked by the experience. Interestingly enough, his damaged characters are not particularly incommoded by their deficiencies. The hair-lipped Nafuz becomes a celebrated mystic and preacher, while Clea, the painter, reports late in the final novel that her prosthetic hand can paint. The gift lies not in her hand, in other words, but in her heart, her mind, her soul. What's Mary Shelley up to, then? Her monster doesn't carry the specific historical baggage of a Jake Barnes, so what does his deformity represent? Let's look at where he comes from. Victor Frankenstein builds his spare parts masterpiece not only out of a graveyard, but also out of a specific historical situation. The Industrial Revolution was just starting up, and this new world would threaten everything people had known during the Enlightenment. At the same time, the new science and the new faith in science, including anatomical research, of course, imperiled many religious and philosophical tenets of English society in the first decades of the 19th century. Thanks to Hollywood, the monster looks like Boris Karloff or Lon Chaney and intimidates us by its sheer physical menace. But in the novel, it's the idea of the monster that is frightening. Or perhaps it's really the idea of the man, the scientist sorcerer, forging an unholy alliance with dark knowledge that scares us. The monster represents, among other things, forbidden insights, a modern pact with the devil, the result of science without ethics. You don't need me to tell you this, naturally. Every time there's an advance in the state of knowledge, a movement into a brave new world, another literary reference, of course, some commentator or other informs us that we're closer to meeting a Frankenstein, meaning, of course, the monster. The monster has several other possible frames of reference. The most obvious literary angle is the Faustian pact with the devil. We keep getting versions of Faust, from Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus to Goethe's Faust to Stephen Vincent Benet's The Devil and Daniel Webster to Damned Yankees to movie versions of Bedazzled and, of course, Darth Vader's Turn to the Dark Side to bluesman Robert Johnson's stories of how he acquired his musical skill in a meeting with a mysterious stranger at a crossroads. The enduring appeal of this cautionary tale suggests how deeply embedded it is in our collective consciousness. Unlike other versions, however, Frankenstein involves no demonic personage offering the damning bargain, so the cautionary being is the product, the monster, rather than the source, the devil, of the unholy act. In his deformity, he projects the perils of man seeking to play God, perils that, as in other non-comic versions, consume the power seeker. Beyond these cautionary elements, though, the real monster is Victor, the monster's maker, or at least a portion of him. Romanticism gave us the notion, rampant throughout the 19th century and still with us in the 21st, of the dual nature of humanity, that in each of us, no matter how well made or socially groomed, a monstrous other exists. The concept explains the fondness for doubles and self-contained others in Victorian fiction, The Prince and the Pauper, 1882, The Master of Ballantrae, The Picture of Dorian Gray, 1891, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Significantly, these last two also involve hideous others, the portrait of Dorian that reveals his corruption and decay, while he himself remains beautiful, and the monstrous Mr. Hyde, into whom the good doctor turns when he drinks the fateful elixir. What they share with Shelley's monster is the implication that within each of us, no matter how civilized, lurk elements that we'd really prefer not to acknowledge, the exact opposite of the Hunchback of Notre Dame or Beauty and the Beast, where a hideous outer form hides the beauty of the inner person. Are deformities and scars therefore always significant? Perhaps not. Perhaps sometimes a scar is simply a scar, a short leg, or a hunchback, merely that. But more often than not, physical markings by their very nature call attention to themselves and signify some psychological or thematic point the writer wants to make. After all, it's easier to introduce characters without imperfections. You give a guy a limp in Chapter 2, he can't go sprinting after the train in Chapter 24. So if a writer brings up a physical problem or handicap or deficiency, he probably means something by it. Now, go figure out Harry Potter's scar. Chapter 22. He's blind for a reason, you know. Here's the setup. You have a man, a largely admirable man, capable, intelligent, strong, if slightly quick to anger, with a problem. Unbeknownst to him, he has committed the two most hideous crimes in the human catalog of evil, So unaware is he of his sins that he agrees to hunt down the criminal, promising all kinds of punishment. An information specialist, someone who can shed light on the search he has undertaken, who can show our hero the truth, is summoned. When the specialist arrives,